Bandwidth for the Weird Things podcast provided by Wired Tree. For sites of any size and world-class customer service, head on over to WiredTree.com.
Hello and welcome to the Weird Things podcast. I'm Andrew Main, joined by Justin Robert Young.
Hi!
Brian Brushwood.
Oh, I'm sorry, I didn't hear you there. I was just listening to the new podcast from Justin Robert Young.
Oh, Mr. Bryce Castillo, are you listening to the new podcast too?
Ooh, you know, I hear great things. I hear it's fantastic.
mainly from me, constantly, nonstop, all day.
Gentlemen, I want to dive right into... Well, apparently we've seen the future of transportation, and it looks a lot like the 1980s idea of the future of transportation.
Oh, my God. I can't wait to get your take on this whole thing, because there are so many victors. For those of you who don't know, Elon Musk introduced his new amazing electric truck called the Cybertruck. It is, shall we say, a bold design with bold claims made about various parts of its structure, and there was a bold... shall we say, unplanned element to the demo he did.
Demonstration, right? You know, you always want to make sure some of the most amazing, iconic moments happen during a physical demonstration. Steve Jobs, of course, the master of this, pulling out the iPod from his pocket, slipping out the first MacBook Air from a manila envelope. Things that are undeniable to our visual senses. And man... did Tesla shoot for the moon by trying to demonstrate their bulletproof windows by throwing a gigantic metal ball into them? And what happened, Andrew?
So Elon had been talking about coming out with a truck for a long time. The Tesla was going to do a truck. And a truck is a great area you want to get into if you want to do transportation. So much of commercial transportation uses trucks. The Ford F-150, you know, is you know, maybe arguably the Conestoga wagon of, you know, contracting and a lot of other. I mean, it's a significant vehicle. So getting to that space is a pretty solid idea. So he'd been teasing the idea of a cyber. He didn't tell us it was a Cybertruck until recently, but this futuristic thing. And he kept saying it looks like something out of Blade Runner. It's going to look crazy. And people are like, yeah, okay. And you'd see concept drawings that were a little bit crazy. You know, a little bit like kind of like, you know, really slanted, you know, front ends and whatever, whatnot. And then at an event that opened up, started off like a David Copperfield show. I mean, there were lasers and everything and smoke machines and stuff. I'm like, man, this is really well produced and really well planned. And then Elon announces the truck and the truck rolls on stage and reactions. Well, you've all seen the reactions to it. They're from, oh, my God, this is cool, to what is this, to, you know, anger, to laughter. I mean, it's a very divisive design. We'll put it that way. Okay. And so Elon goes on, talks about how it's made from, you know, it's made from this stainless steel that's extremely strong. And he does a demo. They bring out a door from a regular truck and they slam it with a sledgehammer and show how easily they can dent it. And so then Elon has his chief designer, Franz von Holzhausen, come out there and say, hey, hit the door of the Cybertruck with it. So he takes the sledgehammer back. He looks a little hesitant, but he goes in and slams it. Door's fine.
But Elon's before like, we get to this, we're seeing the footage of, like, I just don't know that any of the audio listeners can really wrap their mind around just how...
there were lasers constantly firing during the entire event.
I mean,
pyrotechnics, colored light.
The only thing missing is the Trans-Siberian Orchestra playing some amazing metal Christmas music from this thing.
More of a Genesis vibe.
And by the way, I mean, look, Tesla doesn't buy advertising. This is their advertising. Yeah. They rely on word of mouth. And so there is a reason why we're watching a hologram now of a digital sprite speaking to the audience. It is a certainly something that they rely on, that they want to dominate news while this is happening.
So he has Holzhausen hit the door once, Elon's like, do it again twice.
What? And he threw specifically what? A giant steel ball bearing, right?
Well, he's talking about the sledgehammer moment first.
We're not, not even happy. Oh, so he's hitting the door with a sledgehammer. He hits the door with a sledgehammer once, and then, oh, do it again. He does it again. Like, oh, no, do it one more time. So he hits the door again with a sledgehammer. And I'm watching this going like, your chief designer looks a little uncomfortable hitting the door this many times with the sledgehammer. And then they say, hey, let's talk about the glass now and how it's like impact resistant, whatever. And they have this demo with this 20-foot tall, this tent, you know, big, huge tube where they drop the ball through the tube and it hits a sheet of glass, one of their glass to show how resistant it is, et cetera. Which is this, you know, neat demo. Again, looks like a David Copperfield illusion, you know, watch as we put the steel ball through here. Okay. Then he asks Holzhaus and says, I want you to hit the window. I want you to go ahead, hit the window of the Cybertruck that they just pounded the door three times with a sledgehammer with. And I'm going like, all right. And then Holzhausen grabs that ball, throws it at the front window, and smash.
He really, man, even on the first throw,
he kind of lobbed
like
it.
He was pulling his throw a little bit.
Well, I don't think he wants it to ricochet and hit the audience.
Sure. But then also, I think my favorite part is you can hear Elon muttering under his breath, oh my F&G.
Yes. So as soon as that happened, I texted my buddy Ken, who was watching this. I said, the sledgehammer cracked the glass. Like they when they did this demo, I don't think they did the two things together. And then later on, he released video where they showed them same truck beforehand throwing the ball against the glass. And then he said, yep, sledgehammer cracked the door and cracked the base of the glass. I'm like, well, yeah, this is why you got to do these demos together.
Now, would that explain why the back window also cracked?
You hit that body is solid steel, so the vibration of that sledgehammer is getting absorbed by the whole thing. So we're watching video right now of them showing there's like him hurling the ball at the glass beforehand.
Yeah,
which,
I mean, it looks like it works. God.
But the optics, it's optics, maybe.
I mean, okay, so there is some contingency of Twitter that is convinced that this was all an intentional conspiracy, that the whole idea is, hey, man, otherwise this would have been a slightly notable car thing, but this was all orchestrated to get all of us talking about it. But, man, here's the thing. Look at the Pontiac Aztec. The Pontiac Aztec was a bold design with a bunch of functional, cool things about it. It turned into a tent or whatever, but it was slightly too bold. There's something about the way we buy cars that makes us very nervous about ever being laughed at. And as a result, it was only after the failure of the Pontiac Aztec that was decided that that would be the car of Walter White on Breaking Bad to define his practical dorkiness. Man, I feel like they lost more sales than they gained by having the image of this car involve two baseball-sized shatter points on it.
Well, all right. So I think that there's two kind of vectors to that. Number one, was this done deliberately to drive the talking points? While it is indeed true that they do not buy advertising, they need people to be talking about this as much as possible. I am in the camp that they would have generated a lot of talking points, including if they want to mine the derisive nature that much of the internet treats Elon Musk with, they would have gotten that just with the design of the car itself, right? Because it is bold. It is thing that people would have wound up talking about. So I do not think that they intentionally smashed the glass. That being said, I am with you on the Aztec example. The only difference I would say is that the Aztec was launched as a consumer car, right? It was at a price that they wanted to move a lot of units on. The one thing that I can say about the Cybertruck, but by the time that it actually hits, I wonder whether or not, because it stands out, people aren't going to be paying $15,000, $20,000 for this. This is going to be a $35,000, $40,000 vehicle, whether or not it's more like the Escalade or something like that, where it's like it is a big ostentatious design that anybody who's spending that amount of money wants to damn well be sure that everybody on the block knows that it's them.
So I I'm a fanboy, and I would love to believe that that was a planned, but no. And you could see Elon after when that happened. He in his head, he's seeing the tweets and the memes that are going to happen. He can already hear the short sellers and everything else doing that. I do not think. But it's funny that people, you know, we come to that. You know, some people come to that conclusion because it got a ton of amount of press. Here's the, you know, interesting. There was an article about how did the Pontiac Aztec happen, and it's fascinating because it starts off how they showed at a car show years before their concept of what they wanted this thing to be. And it was a much better looking, neat looking kind of crossover kind of vehicle before crossovers became a more popular sort of product line. And it sounded in abstract kind of cool, but then it went from design, you know, change to change to change to become the thing that it was. And then like put it on a less powerful body or less powerful frame and all this sort of stuff. And then all the compromises came in and then this thing came out and it was just, I remember I had a friend that had one of those. I'm looking at this going like, what is, why? But, you know, obviously, you know, whenever somebody tries to do something very different in the car market, we look for comparisons and most of the comparisons we think of are things that are failures. And because we look at like when you try to be too different, then, you know, it's either because it was not a good idea to be too different or whatnot. I would say the real secret of the Tesla of the Cybertruck is forget the way the truck looks. It's all about that. It's all about the frame. It's all about the motors and the battery system, the tech like there. He can have his design studio design it to look like anything. What matters is how powerful that thing is. And I think that's what's, you know, going to be, can they actually deliver it for the price they said? I mean, that $40,000 starting price of $40,000 for something that's bigger than an F-150, that's more powerful, that has all of that. I hope so, you know, but it seems like, man, it feels like a lot of promising once you get past the look of it. But people who on the inside said that it's super spacious, really roomy. And also people I've talked to who've been up to it, saw it in person, said that it looks very different up person, that it's more impressive and whatnot. But
yeah,
I think it's going
to, I gotta be honest, like in the back of my head, I think I would have seriously considered it, but that demo, man, like just driving around and everybody picturing like, hey man, where are the two like there's going to be decals that you put on the window that mimic those two smashes or whatever. Well, that's a real unfortunate part of the story.
Yeah, it won't be out for 2 years.
I would agree with Andrew there. I think that by the time we're gonna have so many more Elon Musk memes by the time that this thing actually rolls out, that who knows? I think that was a big moment for the announcement. It will certainly be something that will make the highlight reel. And as the fate of Tesla and Elon Musk go whatever directions, should it turn south, that will always be the B-roll footage, right? Like if Tesla ever went bankrupt, that's going to be the thing that plays on repeat while they are covering the story. But I don't know. I think that this is, it's such a monumental purchase. I mean, it's a car purchase, and it's so distinctive that I kind of feel like by the time that it rolls out, this will be more about, do I want to drive a RoboCop car than do you remember the time that the windows got smashed?
And he's talked about before this came out, says, you know, we may have to use a more conventional design if this is too radical. So, like, you know, the critical part about that company is their ability to manufacture batteries in bulk, motors, and all the drivetrains and all that stuff. And they can do a lot. Like, the Model Y is on top of the Model 3 drivetrain. This drivetrain, you can put anything on top of there, you know, so, or around it.
I was kind of surprised they didn't go with a flatbed pickup, like an open pickup. That was something that, you know, if you want to get into that market, like, that's standard. You know, that classic for a reason.
I think the strategy is going to be that I think that they know they can only build so much while they ramp up production, basically building the assembly line to build this, because, you know, they're kind of maxed out of the throughput they can do for the Model 3 right now. And I think that when they start building the product, you know, it takes a long time to ramp up to be able to make sure these things deliver without the doors falling off and whatnot, which we've seen previously. I kind of think that this, like I said, because it's about the drivetrain and everything else, is I think that this is probably a really good early adopter vehicle. You're going to get, you know, he says they've had already 200,000 people who've, you know, put down $100 deposit to pre-order or whatever. And I think that that's a really good thing to get the momentum going for the factory, but that factory that could then spit out a more conventional truck too.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, we will see. So, Brian, did you put down a reservation?
I thought about it. I saw them touting the fact that they had made, what was it? I think $200,000 in pre-reservations or
200,000
whatever.
200,000 orders.
What's that?
200,000 orders.
Yeah, 200,000 orders.
Okay. Well, that's significantly better. That's what, $20 million in the bank. To be honest, I've said this before, all the way back to me sporting wacky video game looking hair. I think the world should be more wacky than it currently is. And if we live in a world that is, you know, just wacky enough where these kind of trucks are driving around all over the place, I'm a happy person.
We are watching now a mashup of Magic's biggest secrets finally revealed with the Masked Magician.
Oh, that's from friend of the show, Kate Raft. Oh, my goodness. That's amazing.
Yeah, I think they were watching this on Jack AM and mashing up the glass shattering with the car crush magic.
Oh my god, cutting to the Masked Magician. This is so good.
Yeah, that's hilarious.
But yeah, all right. So Brian, I have not put down a reservation because I don't own a car. Andrew, did you put down a reservation?
What do you think?
You definitely did.
Of course.
You totally did. I got to tell you, what's funny is the only thing that keeps me from, I mean, you know, I don't know. Forgive me. This is, in the grand scheme of things, $100 to grab your spot in line, that seems pretty reasonable. But it's like, I'm sort of increasingly buying into the Jeep culture right now. So I'm, it's like, it's too late for me, Andrew. Godspeed. Enjoy your truck.
I hear you. And I'm looking at this going like, I can't even put this in my garage.
Yeah. Yeah. Look, so, by then you'll have.
I got two years to figure that out or more.
Yeah, man. You get a new place. You'll figure this out.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I love the fact that it probably was not market tested. You know, I love the fact that it was a, hey, let's do something really, really crazy. Go out there with something very bold. And I believe 2 years from now, that truck's going to look a lot more normal.
Plus, also, I wouldn't be surprised at all if the new norm is to have crazy wraps on it. Like, I could see a whole secondary industry of, like, what video game crazy stuff do you want? You want it to look like a Borderlands car? Great, we could do that. You want it to look like a car from this game, that game, the other game? It's utilitarianism, on the one hand, ends up looking superfluously cyberpunky, but I think at the end of the day, that's part of the reason that the price is, and forgive me for saying this about a $50,000 automobile, it's astonishingly low for as bold a design as it is.
Yeah, there have been some concept stuff that's put out there. Some wrap companies already said they're going to do it. I saw the ones where it looked like in black and with white. Looked good. It actually looked like a different sort of, for some reason, just getting away from that steel. I don't know if that's available, Bryce, if you look for like, if you can pull up the images of that.
I feel like the steel was meant to be evocative of like a DeLorean. And unfortunately, there's baggage in the DeLorean. Whereas I guess
I think if it was in black, it would look way better.
Yeah, because then it's evocative of a Batmobile, right?
Yeah. Yeah, we're looking at a black wrapped, you know, Photoshop right now, and that looks pretty cool. Well, I think also because the Starship, it's made from the same steel as they're using for Starship. So for him, it's the idea of, you know, doing that. But yeah, the other thing that's cool is there's video showing how the cover goes on the truck bed, how it slides up and over, and it's actually super hypnotic. Apparently, they say you could stand on it, because for me, I was looking at that like, that looks like a roller shade, and like it's going to make noise if you go fast. But apparently, it slides over, and they say that because there's enough surface area, they'll have one of the solar panel option, which will only give you maybe like 15 miles per day, but it's still kind of a neat idea because if you don't drive a whole lot.
So is that, okay. So it is kind of a roller shade type thing where it's segmented, kind of like you would seal up your bodega in the middle of downtown Manhattan.
Yeah.
as you do. Just hope those damn graffiti artists don't come by. And
so then, I guess then the tailgate comes down, and that's how you get into the bed.
Yeah.
Yeah, the tailgate pulls down into a ramp. Oh, it's because they also unveiled an ATV, and they showed, you know, they have the Tesla ATV, and they showed the guy drive the ATV up the ramp, then plug it into the truck to charge.
Yeah. I mean, look, I agree with you. I think when you first look at it, you're like, oh, my God, that's crazy. It looks like a PlayStation 1 render of a vehicle. It's super weird. I tend to think when I saw the video of people like driving it, I'm like, oh, nobody will mistake what that is. And it does look menacing. And so it's like, if you're going to spend money on that kind of car, then yeah, I think that there is a market for, like, I want a badass truck that everyone knows is badass that doesn't look like an F-150. And I think that's what you're going for.
We're watching more of the footage, and it just breaks my heart that we're now onto the part of the presentation where the star of the show is the fact that they have an ATV that goes in the back, and you just don't see anything but those cracks in the windows. You would think that, like, were this an Apple presentation, they would have said, like, see, it didn't go through. That was what we intended. All right, get this one off, bring on the real one, and then continue with the demo. But instead, they had to continue with that one with the giant cracks.
I mean, yep. It is definitely going to be a thing that people will continue to talk about with this.
Well, those lasers do look cool.
Hey, you want to know what else is cool? Supporting us at patreon.com/weirdthings. If you head on over to patreon.com/weirdthings, you can make sure that we keep doing this show each and every week live on Mondays. Folks, we appreciate your support. patreon.com/weirdthings.
So have you heard about the using in-brain chips to deal with, like, opioid addictions?
No. The closest I've heard about this is Parkinson's disease. Electrical stimulation apparently has had some significant effects in reducing palsy in the hands of Parkinson's folks. Separately, I guess the closest I've heard of is there was also an implant down by the stomach that used electrical impulses to reduce the hunger pangs, and they originally wanted to do it as an alternative to lap band or gastro bypass surgery, but they figured out that this little electrical stimulation only dropped 15 to 20 pounds in most people. So now it's being tested for kind of like mid-level, like somebody just trying
to Googling get my stomach chip now.
Yeah, exactly. but this is the first I've heard of this one. What's the story on this one?
So they're doing the first U.S. clinical trials of a chip, an in-brain chip designed to fight opioid addiction. And it works by sending little signals to certain parts of the brain. And we've been using in-brain chips to do things, as you pointed out, we've been doing for decades. You know, Michael Crichton wrote the book Terminal Man, which talked about, like, the 70s, you know, some of the early, you know, work on that. And it's a very interesting area because we know that you can, you know, the brain has a physical component and you can trigger things and you can do things by prodding and poking. And for some people, you know, opioid addiction is extremely severe. It rewires the brain. And as a way to sort of combat that, I'm cautious, but super hopeful that this might be, you know, we could be moving into a future where you have, like you point out, Brian, that you might do the stomach chip and you might do the brain chip and you might do these other things. And, you know, there could be, you know, two attitudes on it, which would be like, oh, why do we have to do that? But the other point is that, you know, we're fighting evolution in an environment we weren't designed for.
When you are around addiction, you quickly realize that the patterns of addicts are far similar than whether or not they share the same thing that puts them into these patterns of behavior. So being around a alcoholic or an opioid addict or a gambling addict, something like that, you realize that the ways that they interact with the world are far similar to each other, which is always kind of led me to the belief and the science to the idea that, like, you are watching people rewire their brains and you are reacting to stimuli. You are reacting to a pattern of behavior that then leads you into the dissolution of the elements of your lives. So if there is a way, if there is a brain hack that can effectively reset that cycle, because that's all you're ever looking for. And in a 12-step program, in ways that you know, is it Narcan or whatever, but like chemical ways that you can try and get to this, all you're ever hoping for is a break in a pattern and the reestablishment of a new pattern. And that is so much of you fighting against your own brain. If this is a way that you can do that more effectively, I don't think it's a one-stop cure, but man, that would be a powerful tool.
Well, and there are pharmaceuticals that reduce our craving for cigarettes and make us feel physically ill when we encounter alcohol and stuff. So I have a game I want to play. I'll try to make it as short as possible. But let's start with what I think everybody in this room generally agrees is a good thing, is whether it's a chip or a pharmaceutical, a thing that breaks the cycle of addiction to somebody and allows them to return back to society. We all agree that's good, right?
Yes, not for my alcohol and my opiate stocks, but you know.
correct. But then here's the game that's fascinating to me. Whether it's a performance enhancing pharmaceutical or a chip in the brain, how do we feel if, for example, Elon Musk or some other high-powered CEO was using it in order to maximize his work? Like, hey, I went in, I got a surgery, I got a chip in my brain now. Good news, I only sleep 4 hours a night. Odds are I'll die 10 years earlier, but according to all metrics, my creativity is up 35%, my cognitive ability, my communication, blah, blah, blah. All of these things are vastly enhanced. How do we feel about that at a gut level, at sort of a base morality level?
I mean, I think this is happening.
We've heard about CEOs microdosing on LSD or what have you.
Or even just like people taking Adderall. That's
something that I think we've you know, however people are medicating themselves to the point where they believe they're getting peak efficiency is one thing. But, you know, I had a friend of mine who got, you know, way too drunk and then wound up calling a service after he was hungover for like the second day. That basically was a guy that would come in with the saline drip bags, hook you up and rehydrate you. And this dude was telling a story about how most of his work comes from executives throughout San Francisco, because they're the ones that can afford, after they get super trashed, to just have a dude roll by in the morning or before they go to sleep to be rehydrated. So they wake up at 6 o'clock when they're at their, you know, there for the power jog or anything else that they're going to do, because they want to maintain a certain level of optimization. So I don't suspect that for that crowd, there is ever going to be a limit for how they can unlock the most of their potential per day.
So, on the one hand, I think certainly when we're looking at pharmaceutical enhancement or chip enhancement, let's say it's a robot chip put in somebody's brain that makes them crave working out or crave training or whatever. So it's like if somebody's getting ready to compete with the Olympics, I have to imagine that chips enhancing your brains for the purposes of enhanced training would be outlawed, right? Like I think universally that would be frowned upon.
I don't know. I mean, that would be an interesting question, and that it would bring into the idea of, all right, is the Olympics regulating intensity of preparation?
Well, and I was at a party once, and it was mostly academics, and these were really high achieving people from, you know, established universities, et cetera, and people done, you know, stuff you may have heard of, and the subject of like Ritalin came up. And I'm talking to a small group of people there, and they're all like, oh, yeah, I use it. Oh, yeah, I would use it from time. And they're all over 40, and that may have been part of a factor that they're all like, oh, yeah, use it. And I was sort of like baffled, because some of these people were in the neurosciences and stuff and all that. But they're like, to a person, they're all like, have used it or periodically would use that as, you know, to get their work done. And I think that as far as the problem is you can say, hey, we're going to ban such and such a thing, but like, if Brian, if you were, you know, you were an Olympic athlete, you're a rower or something like this, in your off season, if we put you on a cycle of steroids for, you know, 4 months, 5 months, whatever, and then took you off of it, you will have gains and you'll have performance increases that we won't be able to detect when it comes time to test.
Hang on. Let me get a pen.
That's going to be
like a modern rogue episode.
And that's going to be a thing we're getting into is like some of the stuff is hard to detect. You have the Russians really good at doping. Then we figured out a lot of the tricks the Russians were doing. Now we've had, you know, the Chinese who have immense technological capabilities and a huge reason to try to use, you know, state driven means to do this. They can probably outthink, you know, the anti-doping community, or they can actually outthink a lot of the methods there. Cause a lot of the people who are working on those committees are then going back to their home countries and saying, this is how we know how to do this. This is what they can't test for. This is what's going on here. And you could do the brain chip thing and you would never know, you know, how would you test for that? And also it's like, you know,
so. Sure. Well, and I suppose what I'm dialing in on, and this is a thought that I've not really considered before, is in the case of athletes, we have a predominant sense of what we want is fairness, right? And we feel like whether it's pharmaceutical or I suspect that a chip or whatever, like an unfair advantage, like, what's his name was blood doping, you know, putting in fresh oxygenated blood, Livestrong guy.
Oh. Lance Armstrong. Yeah, that was it EPO? I think was the thing he was accused on that was running rampant throughout the cycling world.
Right. And then separately, we hear about the, you know, folks like Peter Thiel having the blood of younger people injected in them on the CEO side. And all of these things sort of subvert our sense of fairness, as Jonathan Haidt would say, our moral taste bud about fairness and cheating. But then how would we feel about firemen getting a chip in their head that made them more alert and better able to do their jobs? So for some reason, the idea of a fireman, even pharmaceutically speaking, like I think as a citizen,
well, our fighter pilots are using speed. I mean, that's a,
Sure. And I guess that's sort of settled territory. So I hadn't really, you know, like we all agree when we're at war, whatever, use all the chemicals, just, you know, defeat the other guy, whoever the other guy is.
I mean, that's the thing. And we don't know how much does that carry over into the commercial space. And so, and that's sort of the thing. If we know that our Air Force aviators, Navy aviators are given, you know, PEP pills, speed pills, all this as a regular basis, they're given this sort of stuff because it's measured. We know the effects. It's better when they're on it, when they're not, presumably. And like, yeah, I think like, you know, would I want my doctor to be using a chip that would make sure that he's not going to forget a sponge inside of me while he's operating me or might reduce hand tremors or something? Sure. Sounds good. I want that guy.
And I guess to a certain extent, oh, that's interesting. So it's like, if you had a choice, through pharmaceuticals, if you're about to go under the knife, would you rather he be on a pharmaceutical that is proven to enhance attention, cognition, and precision or not? Would you rather have your doctor be high or not high if it's the appropriate high while working on you?
Well, and this also assumes that there's no side effects, no crash, no lung.
Sure, right? Sure.
You also don't want a junkie doctor who's not on his stuff.
Correct.
You know?
Correct.
Yeah, I had that once. and it's I had a dentist that was like, I guess he was coked out. It was really weird, you know. It was unnerving. But
whoa. How much? Yeah, you don't have to give his name, but I feel like there's a story here that I just want to cozy in on.
I needed a dentist. This was in Florida. I go there and I Florida, you have me at Florida. All right, I go sit down in the chair, and he comes. It's like, all right, let's take a look here. Let's take a look. All right, okay. All right, open up your mouth there. And he goes, oh wow.
He's muttering. That's what coke addicts do. Is they mutter the word cocaine under their breath all the time.
He goes. He looks at my mouth. And goes, oh, that's really effed up in there, you know. And then he's like, all right, cool. I'll be right back. And you know, he's so twitchy and so this. I'm just. There's nobody in the room. I'm just sort of like. This guy's like on coke. This is like, you know, and he just turns out medical professionals, shocker, high use of cocaine. Who knew?
There's definitely two groups of people that in my casual acquaintances are most comfortable dabbling in pharmaceutical arts. One, of course, is medical professionals, doctors especially, but also I assume dentists and nurses and so on. And then the other is lawyers. It's as though because they're so intimately familiar with the downsides, both legal and physical, they feel like they're uniquely qualified to play with fire.
Yeah, I think there's it's a whole nother discussion there as far as like, yeah, like where how rampant that is and what's considered those norms. But to Bryce's point, like, yeah, Bryce, I agree with you that the concern is we want to make sure that if this is a thing that's used, that we really know that it works, because the pharmaceutical industry is like any other industry. It maximizes profit. It wants to sell you a product, and it will do whatever it can to derive the maximum benefit from said product. And if that means cherry picking studies or pushing something through in a very narrow way, we got to be vigilant about that and make sure and figure out that do these things work. So
the one thing I am, just to go back to the addiction side, I'm very excited to see where we go with, you know, that pattern breaking, that possible idea of like, all right, your rehab begins with us chipping you, and then, you know, we're going to slowly then. I mean, basically, if there was a concept of rehab that did not, that was able to speed up the trauma of we're going to break your brain, and the majority of the rehab was spent trying to reestablish, I think that would be fascinating. It'd be very interesting to see that.
Yeah.
So I guess from our discussion that there's no, because immediately the parallel all of us are drawing are, yeah, it's pretty much like a pill, only it's a chip. So there's no like free pass that it gets by being a physical stimulation of chemicals in your own brain that like it might as well be a pill.
Well, I mean, in my mind, you know, if you look at there are the pills that you have for opioid addicts now that are effective, right? Or medications for that basically try to do part of this, but then also make either, you know, alcohol or opioids physically painful, which is different in my mind than if you were able to break the pattern in your head and therefore you were trying to suppress the initial, just like the signals to say that you want this, as opposed to training your brain to say, no. Whenever you get this, there's going to be tremendous physical pain involved. And so you're trying to rewrite your brain's behavior from there. I mean, to be honest, I don't know what would be more effective, but I think this would be very interesting to watch.
Yeah, I think the advantage over a pill, Brian, is like your point, it's the precision is the idea. You kind of, we theoretically know specifically where it's acting, where, you know, pills and other stuff and other treatments can sometimes affect, you know, you can only measure so many things when you do clinical trials to see how much they affect.
Yeah, I guess this is the futurist in me trying to come out, where I'm thinking to a future where, let's say that a chip does evade stigma, the same stigma that pharmaceuticals have right now. And so at first it's used to treat addiction, then it's used for people who have very important jobs, whether it's soldiers or firemen or police officers or doctors. And then at some point, I guess I'm believing that, oh, you're about to become a parent. Well, are you going to get chipped? It's what's best for your kids. It'll raise your ability to, you know, stay dialed in on them and give them focus and do the reading and all the best practices. So are you a good parent or a bad parent when it comes to, you know, getting chipped for it?
Let me ask you this, Brian. Let's bring it back to some OG weird things.
Oh, torturing my family, yeah.
You have girls that are now, at least two of your girls are now getting into the standardized test phase of their schooling, that there are now tests that you know, especially for Penny, she's going to be getting into the realm of SATs or ACTs, whatever's in fashion. Yeah,
she's in that pre-qualifying for college stage right now.
Yeah, so those are very important, you know, as anybody who's gone through a college admissions process is. Can you imagine a world where you would sign off on, hey, it's a temporary chip, but especially because so much relies, so much pressure is put on a young mind to test well. Is that something that you could see yourself being okay with?
I mean, 100%. Although the only word I would quibble with in what you just said was the idea of temporary, because if it works in the short term and it's sustainable in the long term and it corrects, frustrating or bad or antisocial behaviors or gets the best out of, like, it's still, as they say, by the way, as a project, I'm going to go back and rewatch Gattaca and see how it holds up. If any of you guys want to join me, please do. But I'm going to show it to my kids. There's that moment in Gattaca where they say, no, this is still your child. It's just the best of both of you. And yeah. It doesn't help in this example, the fact that my oldest is, as they say, twice gifted, which means she's wicked, wicked smart, but also has some complications that come along with that. So if we could justify, kind of hide behind the, oh, we're correcting this aspect of it, and along with it, getting the most out of the other thing. But I guess we already see that with kids who are diagnosed ADHD and so on.
So yeah, let's imagine this is not a forever solution. This is a this, you only get one Super Bowl, and that is taking your qualifying test, considering how overweighted and important it is in our modern education system. So this will make you very dialed in. It probably has measurable downside effects of connection to family or friends, but the science is the science. You're going to get, you know, some ridiculous, you know, let's say in the SAT parlance, you know, 400 points on average difference between what you would have before, just by being able to turn off these outside focuses, these outside distractions.
Yeah, I suppose I'm already doing that in terms of, I know that
self-breaking, Brian announced some weird experiments going on in his household.
No, yeah. I mean, there sort of is an experience in that it's de rigueur for everybody to say, limit your kid to so many hours of screen time or whatever. And I got to be honest, you know, I was the kid who, you know, had nonstop screen time in an age before the internet. I was constantly on bulletin board systems, connecting with other people. Now, in the early days, I funneled all of that into antisocial activities like pirating content or whatever, but I also learned an awful lot about what it takes to communicate with the world and to build up social credit. And all of that has ended up benefiting me now in my mid-40s as we go forward. So as my daughter has her entire social life is online. So when she goes up to her room and locks herself off for screen time, I know that the conventional wisdom is limit that screen time, get her out in the real world or whatever. But I strongly suspect that all that will do is make her miserable and yield nothing in terms of real friendships. I think her real friendships are her online friendships, as is evidenced right here. The vast majority of all the time I've spent with both of you guys has been online, and I don't feel like our friendship is any less real, and I feel like all of us are better equipped to handle the fast-paced changes in the 21st century as a result of all the screen time we're doing. So in some ways, we're going against the grain. We're swimming upstream, and I don't know whether I'm right or not, but I yeah. suspect I am.
Screen time is such a horrible phrase, because it's like, I took my device my son uses to chat with his friends from school and socialize away, and now he's upstairs reading Dungeons and Dragons manuals by himself. So much better.
I mean, right.
Yeah. That's really long, but you're like, is that a win?
Yeah. You know? Yes, exactly. I don't know, I guess is my answer to it. But I suspect that reduced version, we're already running that experiment.
All right, let me play this game, okay? Because I can tell you my answer to a lot of these. I'm gonna announce product reveals for new chips. And imagine they just came out, but they said, you know, we've actually military tested. We know these things work. We're going to get rid of the questions of whether or not they're safe. We'll say that, yeah, they're super safe. You can pull them out, blah, blah, blah. Who wants to be the first one here to sign up for, oh, we got a chip that reduces the amount of sleep you need, but apparently it increases the quality of your sleep. So a 5-hour sleep is more like a 10-hour sleep. regenerative, whatever. We model it after people who we find out have extreme longevity, et cetera, but require very little sleep. Sleep chip. Who wants this?
100%. I mean, to me, the big thing is if it's a button I press that I suddenly go to sleep and then it's over with, that would be the best. I did like yesterday, a million. I will rob a bank for this thing.
Brian, you have sleep problems. So literally just a go to sleep chip. Like, forget it could take 8 hours.
Yeah,
like,
as a matter of fact, it could take 12 hours. I could declare that starting now, I sleep 12 hours a day, but I never have that moment of trying to fall asleep. Yeah.
Yep. Yeah.
Justin?
Oh, I would take it. Yeah. Oh, totally.
Bryce?
I don't. Maybe. I don't know. I would say.
I'm sorry, Bryce. In this hypothetical future dystopia, you cannot say maybe's been outlawed.
That's right. As a matter of fact, oh my God, the cyber units are on the way. They're driving their cyber trucks right now. You gotta. You better come up with a firm answer right away.
Get a steel ball and protect myself.
Unless you've got a bunch of steel ball bearings to throw at them, you're screwed.
I would probably say no. I think I would probably say no, but I don't have sleep
spoken
problems.
Spoken like someone in their 20s who sleeps soundly.
They get into some app, Bryce, that Brian presses to go to sleep, which his family would not abuse at all. Don't worry. And I just mean like if you when you naturally go to sleep, say no, this will enhance, but you won't feel you'll get twice the rest when you sleep, you know, and you'll get.
I guess that's it would depend on how invasive the surgery is. Cause I mean, that's brain surgery. And
okay.
That's fair. That's where I'm at.
Injector behind your ear.
Yeah.
I mean, to be honest, I think the thing that pleases me the most about this example is I've long theorized that if I could, I would love to live a 30-hour day instead of 24 hours because, I love being so exhausted that I just collapse and fall instantly to sleep. And once I do fall asleep, I love going as long as I possibly can. So I've long theorized that I would love to do a 20-hour work day and then a 10-hour sleep night. And so this sounds as close to that as I could get.
Most of us are on board. Here's the next one. This is the workout chip. This is very interesting. What this does is it makes it when you work out, you can work out to a higher intensity. It minimizes the amount of pain or exhaustion you feel while you work out. So you can spend 20 or 30 minutes working out. Maximizes, helps your body regulate everything it needs to do that, and actually can help trigger things like the growth hormones, things like this naturally in your body. But basically what it does is we looked at the brains of athletes and people who love to work out and love to do like crazy sessions and stuff, and we figured out how to do this to your brain.
This one kind of exists, and tell me if you agree with this or not, it kind of exists already in the form of a trainer, because we know that you could pay money and then by virtue of having somebody hold you accountable to show up, you show up more often, you work out harder because somebody's encouraging you person to person, and you get more out of it. But I guess the idea of the chip would be that it would be just instinctual and you would be able to do it on your own?
Well, the trainer, I mean, everybody sort of responds differently. And trainers work for many people for a period of time. And then after a period of time, the trainer becomes less, because also certain people have better predispositions towards working out. There's some people who just have that, like, I got that adrenaline rush and I loved it and that runner's high and I've ran, I've done everything. I've never had that. I've never been like, this feels great. I do it because like I have to.
Right.
Yeah. I would take a pass on this one because I suspect that there will be others that will help me with fitness goals that don't necessarily have to do with the, you know, a chip that makes me want to be The Rock, working out at 3:30 in the morning with gigantic chains around my neck. But I suspect that I would be able, what I really want is increased focus. And so I will take a pass on the specific workout one.
I'd consider this one, you know, I went to the gym in my apartment this weekend. And I kind of didn't know I had to look them online. What sets should I do? What should I do this? I could see that. Yeah.
Dude, I love the idea of Swole Bryce. I just want to picture Swole Bryce walking in, just looking like The Rock and just sits down.
There was a kid in my high school who was, he was short, skinny guy. And then he got kind of nice guy, but kind of like sort of the person nobody paid attention to. And then he got like serious hardcore working out, and maybe he used steroids. I don't know. But I watched that personality transformation where all of a sudden he became this much more confident guy. He didn't become a jerk. He became what was been interesting just watching that once his external shell sort of became this a little more noticeable and athletic and whatnot. I saw it was an amazing transformation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and keep in mind, there's little things that change, like when your body becomes more muscular, you carry yourself differently. And as we know from various psychological studies, there was one study that you had to bite a pencil, which inherently made your mouth smile. And then people reported general better senses of well-being compared to if you had to bite a pencil with it lengthwise, sticking out of your mouth like a straw, bite down, that sort of inherently makes a frown. So it's like just the mere fact that you're forced to smile or forced to frown, even if you don't know you're being forced to do those things, seems to shape everything. So I would imagine inherently being stronger and more powerful, carrying yourself straight up, just gives you a general sense of well-being where the little things don't bite as hard.
Want to know how I got these scars? It was a study. It was really weird. Last chip.
All right.
Okay. You ready for this?
Yep. Let's go.
You know, you every now and then, you don't want to, but you find yourself in a situation where like a car accident or something, or house on fire, or somebody needs help, or maybe you're being assaulted or attacked or whatever. This chip, what'll do, it'll elevate your adrenaline. It will increase your strength. Things that we could do, you know, basically flip you into rock mode.
So question, the first thing that I worry about is there's a number of times in my life that I have adrenaline rushes and they're not me being attacked. Like, are we correcting for false positives? Like, just because you're nervous before a big speech, or maybe you get bad news from the office, we're assuming that the chip is able to distinguish between life-threatening situations?
Yeah, it's a watch. You just press it on, like, all right, you know, there was...
But also, it's like if you're getting nervous before a big presentation, then this chip might mean that you walk out and you are the rock, right? Like you have that gravitas. Now all of a sudden, you are projecting by way of what you just talked about, the posture, the fact that there is like so much oxygen coursing through you as you kind of like harness it, but you don't feel, you feel on top of it and not having it consume you.
Well, let me do another thing, but a chip that, let's say your body suffers some sort of trauma, it keeps you from going into shock, keeps you from, you know, bleeding out, does whatever it needs to do to keep you calm, so you increases your chances of survival.
I mean, that seems like it should be put in every infant.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
That seems, if
that
there
seems
is
like a safety belt.
Yeah, that makes you just more durable as a thing. That seems like the kind of life-saving element that should probably be put into every single human.
That might be something we see, because there are certain things that you're, you know, we're physiologically that you can do that increase your survival chances. So something that auto-regulates whatever. So
I mean, yeah, like that to me is the same thing as doing like Mommy and Me swim classes when a baby is an infant, just so they know how to, you know, not drown in a pool.
Yeah. I guess that's the thing too, is there might be some very basic muscle memory skills that might be implantable by chip too.
Shoot, I guess, like now, swimming. I can't think of a better segue to ever bring this up, but keep an eye out on future Modern Rogue programming, because talking about getting chips implanted in you, one co-host of the Modern Rogue, Jason Murphy, got chipped by a friend of Devian Olive, who's a hacking legend, a penetration tester. He has in him a subdermal chip implanted that is programmable by, get this, your iPhone. All you have to do is set it up to write on it. And so it was the weirdest thing. He got chipped. And then I was like, what are you going to put on? He's like, I don't know, whatever you want. And he was like, wait, you're going to let me program you? And he's like, yeah, sure. So I uploaded a thing so that now the human being, Jason Murphy, if you walk up and hold up an iPhone, the RFID chip triggers a link that causes Mr. Roboto to play on YouTube. And I asked him what he was going to swap it with. He goes, I don't know. That's pretty good. So that's where he's at right now.
All right, let's do some picks.
Hey, when to go see a movie on Friday? It's called Ford versus Ferrari, but it might as well be called Boy Stuff. Man, do you like boy stuff? Do you like cars? Man, is this car? Is this movie got cars? Not being good at your finances and disappointing your wife? Boy, does this movie have that too. Male friendships? Hell yeah. Europe? I mean, I guess that also counts. Look, it's a good movie. I can't speak to how much it is. Obviously, it's based on a true story. I am not a car historian, so I am not aware of where it deviates from the what really happened. I do know it's the first time that I've watched a movie with Christian Bale where he's playing the guy that was recorded on the set of Terminator Salvation, threatening to trash his lights. So
it's a character study in himself.
Yeah. Very, very short-tempered, thicker British accent than you might expect, but undeniably good at his craft. The Christian Bale playing himself in Ford versus Ferrari.
So the review on Ford versus Ferrari is, oh, good. Good yeah. for you.
Good for you. Like, honestly, I would love to hear that those clips matched up against some of his scenes in Ford versus Ferrari, because it is uncanny. And in all seriousness, it's a great Matt Damon performance, great Christian Bale performance. Spoiler alert. To be honest, I don't know why they called it Ford versus Ferrari, because you know who's going to win, because the movie's not in Italian.
Yeah. So I saw a movie. I saw a couple of movies. I saw that Frozen 2. Turns out there's exactly one scene worth watching in Frozen 2. And we got to see it because I took the kids to go see it. And then I went to go see a movie later that night. And as we're walking by the theater, about to go up to the movie that I'm about to reveal, we see Frozen 2 and I'm looking at it. I'm like, oh, I think, hey, Bonnie, there's exactly one scene worth watching in Frozen 2. And so I was like, let's duck in. So we duck into the theater, happened to be right when that scene was happening. It was freaking great. And then and I was like, all right, you've seen everything you need to see from Frozen 2. And then off we go. But the movie we went and saw, sadly poorly attended, should be a full theater. Everybody should go see it. Favorite thing I've seen in a very long time, Jojo Rabbit was an absolute freaking joy. There was not a second of that thing that I did not love. I laughed so very, very much about during it. I cried at one point. It was just a delight. I can't say, like, go see it before. I mean, it'll be fine on the small screen, but go see it if you can while it's still on the big screen, mainly to cast your dollar vote so that Disney, this is one, Bryce, am I right in understanding mm-hmm. this? This was it a Fox deal and then it got acquired and then Disney kind of soft released right. it because they're not big on, you know, Hitler youth movies with a fictitious Taika Waititi Hitler?
Yeah, it's a Fox Searchlight release. So it's one of their smaller brands. And yeah, my understanding is that some of the promotion, they kind of turned the knob down a little bit. There were questions of if they were going to release it, but it seems that they did.
And even I seem to remember seeing on Taika Waititi's Twitter feed, even he soft sold it, saying, hey, I made a really quirky movie. Go see it, I guess, if you want to go see something.
That's how you would sell a movie if you made really quirky made a movie, though.
But it comes on strong with sort of the transgressive nature of it taking place. It's a flippant movie set in you know, Nazi Germany, and it's evocative of, if you ever saw To Be or Not to Be with Mel Brooks, or likewise the producers. It makes light of a dark time, but it also is very respectful of the very real consequences on it. Sam Rockwell is fantastic in it. The kid is amazing in it. Taika Waititi is an adorable imaginary Hitler who, if you're not familiar with the conceit, Hitler is his imaginary, it's a 10-year-old's imaginary friend. And
no, Brian, Hitler was very real.
Scarlett Johansson is the mom, and she's just heartbreakingly wonderful at trying to make the world a positive, joyful place in the middle of a total crap show. I loved Jojo Rabbit so much, and I'm hoping all of you guys will watch it so we can talk about it.
Cool. Thanks. You ever see Hunt for the Wilder People?
Not yet. That's when I'm saving it like a dessert. I know it's going to be great.
If you, I haven't seen Jojo Rabbit, but from what I can gather, it is a more fantastical the exploration of some of the themes that were there in Hunt for the Wilder People. But Hunt for the Wilder People is bonkers good.
Oh, I can't wait. I can't wait.
That was Taika Waititi right before What We Do in the Shadows. Is that right?
No, it came out after. The Shadow was first, and then Hunt for the Wilder People. So I've been holding on to that one. Jojo Rabbit, just a heads up. Go into it expecting to see somebody doing their best impression of Wes Anderson. Like, get over the fact that it's very Wes Anderson-y.
That it is Moonrise Kingdom with Hitler in...
Correct. That's exactly what it is. It's Moonrise Kingdom with Hitler. Man, was it ever a joy. I enjoyed it.
Yeah, that was. I remember when some of the reviews came out, and they're like, "Oh, this is Moonrise Kingdom with a fake Hitler," and I'm like, "Really?"
You're like, "What about this? Does not sound awesome?"
Why did you put that on the poster, idiot?
That's how I was when Overwatch was announced, and everyone's like, "This is just Team Fortress 2 with upgraded graphics and better character design," and I'm like, "Yes."
Bryce?
I got a pick. So over the weekend, I had some friends over, and we rewatched this movie. I don't know if I mentioned this on the show before, or maybe I might have been. This might have been a pick when I went and saw it in the theaters, but we watched The Art of Self-Defense, which has got Jesse Eisenberg and Imogen Poots in it. This is a really, really funny movie, and watching it again, especially with people who had not seen it, and I had seen it, heightened sort of all of the very awkward humor of the movie. It's about Jesse Eisenberg as a very milquetoast sort of accountant who gets beat up in the street one day by a motorcycle gang, and ends up taking a karate class to be able to defend himself. And the story stuff happens. It's very good. It was only like $10 to buy the digital version of the movie. So I really recommend it. Especially if you can go in with not knowing too much, like maybe don't see the trailer. I had someone who was watching it this weekend with us, who said a line like 10 seconds before the person on screen said the line. And I was like, just let him say the thing. Anyway, Art of Self-Defense. I think it's very good. Jesse Eisenberg, Riley Steams.
Can I give you guys a little bit of weird trivia? Just go back to the IMDb page you had for that.
Sure.
Okay, who's the actor on the right? That not in Art of Self-Defense, the other movie.
Oh, the random article that is the kid from A Christmas Story.
Yep. What was the last movie you saw him in?
I believe that was it. He was a one-and-done child actor, right?
Final answer?
Sure.
Sure, yeah.
Spider-Man Far From Home. Remember the guy that controlled Mysterio's computer simulations?
No kidding!
Wow. Peter Billingsley.
How fun!
Oh my goodness.
Yeah, he that they retconned him back into being yelled at, you know, in the Iron Man movie and all of that, you know. So,
oh, that's great.
Wow.
Yeah. He was big back in the day, and then, you know, he went away, but then I'm watching Far From Home again, and I'm like, "Hey, wait, that's that face." And I look it up. I'm like, "OMG, it's Peter Billingsley."
I'll tell you what, man. Hollywood is a crazy town. There was a production assistant on the TV show Hacking the System that we were doing, and he was one of the hardest working. Just, you know, put his head down, stoic, get the work done. Reliable, wonderful, awesome, fun to hang out with. And like one of the very last days, it comes up in conversation that he's the kid from the movie Fargo. And but meanwhile, super humble, super cool, just awesome, just working in the biz. It's crazy.
Wow.
Yeah. All right, trivia question for you. What do The Walking Dead, Black Panther, and Medea Family Funeral all have in common?
None of my money.
Wow. No, I don't know.
They were all shot in Atlanta?
Yes. All shot in Atlanta at Tyler Perry Studios. I happened upon a video the other day, which is a YouTube video, of Tyler Perry for architect who's showing off to Architectural Digest the whole studio compound he has there, which is on a former military base. And it was a really interesting thing because Tyler Perry, he's like Seth MacFarlane. I love the guy. I'm not into the product, right? Yeah. You know, like it's not for me, but I admire how creative and how, you know, how hardworking he has been. And it's really neat. You see this big, huge 300-acre studio compound they have with their own sets, with, you know, versions of the White House, all the stuff. They have sound stages. They produce a lot of movies there, like the Walking Dead shot there, mentioned Black Panther, etc. And he's a guy that made his way into entertainment from outside. You know, he started as a playwright with a play that bombed and just worked at it for a number of years and finally made it into a movie for $5 million that made $50 million. And then he realized, like, hey, there's an audience out there that's being underserved. Let me create content for him. And he built up his own media empire. You know, he owns all of his movies outright. Lionsgate distributes them. He produces like half a dozen TV shows, etc. So I just was watching this. It was neat. It was neat to see somebody who just made it from outside the system and by his own rules. You know?
And for the record, God bless him. Good luck. If you ask me, that's 293 too many acres. I mean, you don't want to have that many acres.
True. He's compensating, Brian. He's compensating. Yeah.
Not just movies and television shows. The last Democratic presidential debate last week from Tyler Perry.
No kidding.
Wow.
Yep.
Usually you would think that would be at like a school or a
university or something. Yeah. But yeah, no, they set up the entire set staging, you know, aired on MSNBC from Tyler Perry Studios. And I believe it's not only just a former military base. I think it was initially a former Confederate military base, which is part of the story from Tyler Perry's perspective that now he built the first Black-owned massive studio on Confederate military base.
See Robert E. Lee talking to like a psychic who's like, let's look into the ball. I'm going to show you the future of what's going to happen here.
There is something.
All of a sudden, like the psychic's like, hello.
Cool. Anyhow, worth checking out because again, I love stories like that. I love stories of people who just, you know, probably were treated as outsiders, felt like outsiders. And when he went through a lot as a young man, I mean, just as a kid, whatever, and to be where he is, whatever, I think we can all take some inspiration from. On that note, it's been weird.
Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.